I bring my thoughts with a huge amount of humility and a huge amount of interest in what you're doing.
This is our Finambulist logo. As you can see, Karachi is over there.
How we have for such a long time be so complicit in this planetary ecocide.
Clearly, if it needs to be one group of people to the detriment of every others, it will always be like for the political struggles themselves.
But for some reason, we have decided to disrupt that ecological balance way more than any other species.
Think of ecology in the least technocratic way, the way indigenous nations have been cultivating a certain relationship to their direct environment.
And reflecting on overconsumption and things like that. This could be an interesting thing to look at.
Like, our project is focused around this idea of wonder.
When you say other people or the audience or something like that, who are we talking about?
Graphical, digital stages where these players will be fighting. But
how do you use Street Fighter as a way to engage people on the topic of human and non-human interaction?
Yeah. Imagine, for example, if you played the game by holding leaves of a plant, you know, rather than a joystick.
We are just talking to them about all the species in the mangroves.
Turns out it was a 16-year-old boy who cut the tree away, and it caused a huge nationwide outcry about this vandalism.
Like, what we do is like guerrilla gardening, or we try to like rescue plants.
Or write some book, or why do you not just like do a lecture for people to learn about this? There's a thing about artwork which is powerful. It's on an emotional level.
We exist in design circles in a sector that has morally disengaged from its climate impact.
We've been talking about greenwashing as well as innovation washing. And on top of it, now you have moral disengagement.
Where greenwashing comes up a lot in conversation, but we wouldn't be where we are if people hadn't done a bunch of things that they, you know, are not proud of. For me, innovation washing is slightly different. Forms of tax evasion that come into form as R&D departments that have no intention of turning their R&D work into actual work, you know, and they are performative pieces of work. I think we don't have time anymore for that.
Hello, welcome everyone. This is one of those exciting guest sessions we've been anticipating for a while. So we've got a very special guest, Hira Sheikh, with us, who's been doing some great work with Digital Lab and Research Centre at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. And we've got a very special guest along with Hira, Professor Marcus, and doing some great work. But a rather informal introduction about Hira Sheikh and Professor Marcus. Over to a very special collaborator, artistic director of the residency, architect, designer, musician par excellence, Usman. So over to you, Usman.
Thanks. Well, you know, I had not come across Hira's work prior to discovering a paper recently, which I sent to all of you on multi-species governance in cities. Let me just make sure I have the title correct. More Than Human, Smart Urban Governance, a Research Agenda, which was fantastic on many levels, but in particular because it really goes to the heart of what we're trying to look at with this residency. And so I'm very happy to have found that paper, and also to discover, Hira, that you're actually Pakistani, that you are also from an architecture background, and that there are many kind of similarities and hopefully crossovers. Really happy that you are able to make some time to talk with us today. I've followed Marcus's work for a long time. It's been an influence on mine. We have only met in person twice, but he's also an architect and passionate about very similar things to do with multi-species urbanism, to do with participatory frameworks, and to do with responding to the climate emergency. I will leave it to you and take it from here.
Thank you. Too kind.
Moving forward with Hira's deliberations today. So over to you, Hira.
Thank you. Today, I'll be sharing part of my PhD research that I developed with my supervisors, Professor Marcus Forth, who is with us today, and Professor Peter Mitchell, as a talk entitled More Than Humans, Smart Urban Governance. My research sets out to explore smart urban governance for more than human world and multi-species justice. Before I dwell further into my research, I will quickly describe what I mean by these three terms, that is smart urban governance, more than human, and multi-species justice. First, let's understand what is smart urban governance. Smart urban governance is a practice where different political actors from governments, businesses, communities, NGOs use digital technologies and data to govern cities. Next up, we have the term more than human. It was introduced by scholar David Abraham to decentralize human exceptionalism and centralized human entanglement with non-human life forms. For example, animals and plants. And lastly, we have the term multi-species justice, which is very closely related to the term more than human. Multi-species justice refers to justice not just for humans, but for the interconnected human and non-human relations, which includes justice for animals, plants, microbes, rivers, forests, and other natural ecosystems. So after having described those terms, now I'll begin talking about my work. As I mentioned earlier, my research explores smart urban governance for multi-species justice. But why is it critical to explore multi-species justice and smart urban governance? Cities, and specifically smart cities, have long been co-opted into fantasies of human centrality and exceptionalism from other species. Against the backdrop of urban biodiversity loss, smart urban governance is increasingly criticized for its human-centered focus. Cities, while they're primarily designed for humans, are teeming with plants and other animals. Further, today, this urban biodiversity is increasingly known through environmental monitoring technologies. These technologies and resulting data often reduce non-human species into calculable, perceivable, and governable risks within a humanist framing, where humans control and manage them as object of their governance. Consequently, the realization of multi-species justice is much needed in the context of smart urban governance. Smart urban governance has and continues to factor out non-human species and multi-species justice. Therefore, to fill in this gap, both in theory and practice, in my research, I engage with the concept of more than human to reconfigure contemporary articulations of smart urban governance. My work reviews more than human literature across the three interconnected dimensions of smart urban governance, that is cities, digital technologies, data, and politics. Based on this literature and knowledge gap, I propose the research agenda More Than Human, Smart Urban Governance. But before I present this nascent agenda today, I will take you through learnings I gathered by studying each of the three dimensions of smart urban governance through a more than human lens. The first dimension is cities. Until recently, urban studies has conceived of modern city as a humanist citadel constructed for and by humanity alone, excluding the non-human. Recently, many scholars, including Jennifer Walsh's seminal work, Zoopolis, in the book Animal Geographies, have called for the recognition of non-human life within city spaces. This has led to an increased understanding of the need for urban design to consider the plethora of urban species and their fundamental rights to shelter, food, and health. My takeaway from the More Than Human studies on cities was that we as humans should attune ourselves to the spatial and temporal needs of multiple species. Spatially, this could mean having urban wildlife corridors so animals can have sufficient habitat, food, and move safely within cities. Temporally, this could mean respecting non-human circadian rhythms and avoiding light pollution at night, as it has negatively affected many creatures, including amphibians, birds, mammals, insects, and plants. Of course, these are only two examples among many. The second dimension is digital technologies and data. In recent decades, digital technologies and data are being put to service to promote environmental governance. When we think about biodiversity loss within cities, we often do think with data. Urban nature is increasingly known through smart assemblages of drones, satellites, and sensors. The collected environmental data is often represented as species categories, occurrence, and movement records as lists or dot points on maps, capturing human life from a human perspective. And Jennifer Gebres, among other scholars, argues to reconfigure these environmental technologies from a multi-species perspective. In her book, Program Earth, as she criticizes them for reducing non-human life forms into range of calculable, perceivable, and governable risks. My takeaway from more than human studies on digital technologies and data was that these smart technologies can also be geared towards listening and responding to non-human communication. Eduardo Cohen, in his book, How Forests Think, contends that all living beings communicate through signs. Michelle Wister Lincoln describes non-human signs as language of their sounds, smells, gestures, and bodily movements. Some examples of non-human communications are bees use waggle dance to communicate distance and direction of food sources. Many insects, including bees and ants, use pheromones to communicate, and trees and plants use fungal networks to send signals and nutrients to each other. By capturing such non-human signs, digital technologies can be used more consciously to bring forth the deserving stories of diverse urban species with minimum intrusion and circumscription of multi-species worlds within and by human narration. However, it is critical to realize that all attempts to understand the non-human perspective and their experiences through signs to some degree has and will always rely on human mediation. The third dimension is politics. Most non-human beings have lost their natural habitat to urbanization. Such violence against non-human life is sustained through their non-political status. And in these times, we urgently need to question the prevalent political frameworks that continuously fail to afford spatial and temporal justice for non-human life. Rights of Nature movement is one such effort that argues for the rights of nature as essential and non-negotiable. Two seminal works that propel the discourse on rights of nature are Zoopolis, A Political Theory of Animal Rights by Sue Donaldson and Bill Kimliga, and Should Trees Have Standing by Christopher Stone. And today, we also have practical examples of rivers in New Zealand and India being given constitutional rights. Another movement is of more than human politics, which is largely theoretical at the moment, but it argues for expansion of human political practices to acknowledge and engage with non-human communicative and political systems. This shift is in political subjectivity necessitates more for our political systems than just personifying human rights. It requires us to recognize non-human life as political subjects. My main takeaway from more than human studies on politics is that non-human beings also partake in political partnerships outside human political systems. A concept discussed by Rafi Yuad, among other multi-species justice scholars. The politics across the animal and plant kingdoms include collective intelligence, labor distribution, warning signals, sacrificial actions to protect their kin and various other symbiotic and parasitic partnerships. Learning from these concepts, we may ask, how can humans find better ways to live with plants and animals in the city? Let's discuss a few practical examples. First example shows how bees in our cities. German biologist Karl von Frisch describes how bees use waggle dance, a figure eight movement, to communicate the location of their food sources amongst each other. And scientists are now also using machine vision technology to decode bees' waggle dance. And this setup uses video camera to identify, decode, and map the frequency of communicative dance movements in real time. Later, logarithms calculate the dance orientation and time span to figure out the location of food sources which the bees are communicating to each other. Such data communicating bees' modes of being can help humans design better cities for them. For example, designer Mathilde, in her project Insectology, designed artificial flowers that transform rain into sugar water to function as emergency food for urban pollinators. By understanding communication processes like bees' waggle dance, we can better respond to bees' needs, for instance, by locating Matilda's artificial flowers in location where urban bees cannot find food during foraging season. Bee communication is not limited to bodily movements. They also use odors and pheromones to communicate with each other. And that opens up a variety of senses humans can tap into to govern better urban spaces for bees. Second example shows how we can support birds in our cities. Biologist David Huskell describes that bird utterances are imbued with understanding, full of representation, organized by rules, powered by creativity, and shaped by culture and context. Bird sound making has internal grammatical rules. Their brains learn and innovate. Birds hear and remember nuances of sound, connecting abstract acoustic patterns to the physicality of their ecological and social worlds. They listen to the voices of other species and understand what is meant. Specific bird songs have specific meanings. It might be a call to attract mate, an expression of hunger, or birds communicating their movements amongst kin without disclosing their location to their predators. Often, human-centered urban spaces negatively affect bird communication. For example, the volume of passing cars can result in birds living close to a highway no longer being able to hear and locate each other, and thus decrease in population. Further research in bioacoustics has confirmed that anthropogenic traffic noises in urban environment hinders birds' ability to guard their territories, regulate their immune system, and attract mates. Although it might not be entirely possible yet, several human-computer interaction designers are experimenting with machine learning to decode bird songs and behavioral cues to gain insight into their world. For instance, decoding bird language to understand its different meanings can offer data to urban actors based on which they can create policies necessary, stating that noise pollution levels should not exceed a limit where bird communication of local species is disrupted. Further, policies can specify ways to buffer traffic noise by planting trees in loud neighborhoods. Further design interventions can also be integrated into cities by understanding how birds view their environment. For example, to await the millions of bird deaths caused by building windows in cities, designers Matthew and Mathis, in their project Highlight the Invisible, propose adding minerals that are invisible to the human eye but emit UV waves visible to birds to glass windows to prevent accidents. Data informing what the birds really see is a crucial first step towards understanding their behavior. Many ecological studies are now taking into account the differences between avian and human vision. Similarly, designers in attempting to see the world through a bird's point of view show us one way how design of the building might be unlearned and relearned. Possibly governing multi-species justice then first entails the recognition that different species use urban spaces and perceive them differently than humans. Third example shows how we can support trees in our cities. As established by many scientists and recent upsurge in plant intelligence discourse, the power of trees includes a wide range of communicative mechanisms, including olfactory, visual, electrical, and possibly even acoustic signals. The ecologist Suzanne Simard is credited for her seminal work on the study of tree communication, where she illustrates how trees communicate with each other through an underground network of fungi. The novelist Richard Powers, inspired by ecologist Suzanne Simard's research, describes trees' relationship with its environment as trees know things. They wire themselves up underground. Link enough trees together and a forest grows aware. The tree-fungus relations that Suzanne discovered and Power illustrates are not limited to forests. 90% of all the trees on Earth have a symbiotic relationship with fungi to communicate with each other via the exchange of nutrients and warning signals about parasites. Trees in urban environments are similarly connected through fungal networks. Urban trees, however, have weaker tree-fungus communication networks due to the decline of fungi in urban spaces because of human activities such as excessive soil being covered with concrete surfaces. In the absence of tree-fungus communication, the capacity of trees to flourish in urban ecosystems is compromised as they become more vulnerable to diseases and lack of sufficient nutrients. Drawing on environmental politics scholar David Scholesberg, I argue the mutilation of tree-fungus communication networks on urban land can be regarded as multi-species injustice. Scholesberg argues that multi-species injustice constitutes any harm inflicted on non-human bodily integrity and their basic functioning to acquire food safety and shelter. Therefore, solely protecting trees from being cut down. However, by observing the communicative networks in trees, policies can guide developmental plans to ensure that urban tree communities maintain spatial connections through their underground fungal networks. In keeping with this concept, Nadine Gill and co-authors also introduced an approach they term Internet of Nature, encouraging the use of digital technology to enhance the functioning and benefits of tree-fungus relations. They prescribe the utilization of data representing tree-fungus relations to foster urban governance that values and understands these ecosystems. In this talk, 3 species were considered, but the research serves as a starting point for an ongoing conversation about how smart urban governance can better accommodate the other animals and plants we share cities with. Based on the literature and discussed examples, in conclusion, I propose the research agenda for more than human smart urban governance, suggesting that the future work within this emergent space could be mindful of and responsive to the spatial temporal needs and communicative and political capacities of non-human life forms through design, planning, digital technologies, data, and governance practices.
Thank you so much, Hira. I think that was super comprehensive and very well put together in terms of what our participants have been discussing. Sunila, if you'd like to ask anything regarding her practice and what she's been theorizing.
Hi, Hira. Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I did note down quite a few of the references you were referring to, but I'll look it up further. I just want to know that since your the overall idea is based on an assumption that there is a strong digital knowledge available amongst the the community or the locals. What if it is a context like poorer neighborhood or an informal illiterate neighborhood or something like that where digital knowledge or digital accessibility is not available? So have you thought, like, is that a part of your overall process, or is that a context that you would think about?
I think that's a very good question. My research was particularly sort of framed around this smart urban governance. So it does look at the specific area of how potentially digital technologies and data can be used. But the other aspect of my research was that actually there are already a lot of, especially in Australia, indigenous practices where people have already been sort of connecting to nature and listening to nature in different ways. And I think technology is just doing what people do. Different bird songs and respond to them, or different needs of nature. So I think there's always more potential for that as well. Using digital technologies and data is just one way. And that doesn't necessarily mean that technology needs to be present all the time. It can just be like simply your smartphone or just having journal knowledge about certain things that plants and animals communicate, raising awareness of that within communities and seeing how people can maybe start to engage with them, how certain communities have always engaged with non-humans.
Right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Usman, you had a question, so please.
Yeah, thank you, Hira. That was really fantastic. I actually have lots of questions. One I'll start with, I sort of have an answer to of my own, but I'm very curious to know how you see this. And by the way, Marcus, please jump in as well. It'd be great if you have some thoughts. There is an argument in designing for more than human frameworks that it's because power is already concentrated in the humans, that it's a bit patronizing almost to do this on their behalf, as it were, in a very anthropocentric way. And I'm just wondering, how do you see that? What is the role of the human? And why is this important for humans to be conscious of and responsive to these issues?
I think the most important part for humans is to probably realize that they're being destructive towards the environment, and how our political systems currently work. It's not just about us having a savior complex to save the nature, but it's sort of more about realizing the damages that we are doing. And human intervention just needs to be minimal. And I think part of recognizing non-human communication in their political system is sort of saying that they already have the agency. They already have political systems in which they thrive and they know how to nourish them. And even with the examples of the way trees connect themselves, we humans are not sort of connecting them together. They are already doing that. All we have to do is not disrupt those processes. And the more understanding we have of those processes and the way nature works and their agency operates, the more we can stop being destructive. And I think that's where human agency sort of lies.
Marcus, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah,
thanks.
Sure.
That's a great response.
Let's see what I can muster at 9:30 at night. I would add to what Hera has already quite beautifully articulated, that it's also a matter of recognizing that humans cannot not be humans. Like the statement that you started with, to kind of say, well, it's in essence really difficult for us to put ourselves into the shoes of another species. There is a whole bunch of different speculative design methods, other kinds of methods in terms of role play, in terms of trying to imagine what it would be like. But at the same time, I think what some of this work is alluding to is the fact that kind of design remit is often cast and set up in a particular strategic way in order to enable us to focus on a designerly solution, opportunity space, the kinds of sandbox, right, within which we operate. And what we're trying to do with not just Hera's PhD, but the research group at QUT is actually kind of trying to push the boundaries and question some of the stuff that's outside that sandbox, which is question some of the economic frameworks, like the fact that we kind of work towards the design brief. The brief has been given to us by a company or a government department. Well, let's question some of the assumptions. And so once you start scruffers on this design thinking house of cards, eventually it'll actually collapse, because you realize that there is so much emphasis on selling shit rather than giving a shit. And so that is really the kind of problem, that it's this dichotomy between the commercial realities within which the design practice is usually embedded within, and the kinds of really radical ontological and epistemological reform work that is required. And that's where learning and having that privilege of being here in Australia, learning from Indigenous First Nations peoples here, that actually have managed to live in harmony with nature for you know, not just generations, but over 60,000 years. And so when we are, again, just starting to, I think, begin to realize the profound wisdom and experience that they are bringing to the equation. And what our task now is to try and translate this into something practical. One of the very practical elements that I find fascinating is how there wasn't really the need for a what might be called, you know, an Environmental Protection Biodiversity Act, which is in essence a piece of legislation that says you shall not pollute the environment, you shall not kill the koala, you shall protect the seas and the lands, and, you know, you shall not cut down all the trees. Like the fact that we, as coming from largely a Western philosophical worldview, require a legislative body is actually relatively foreign to Indigenous Australians that have grown up with a cultural obligation. The obligation is usually referred to as caring for country. And when I first arrived in Australia, it was a term that I understood. I understood the meaning of care. I understood country, but I didn't really, until recently, make that profound connection of what they really meant by it, which is that place comes first, and you have a connection to place right from birth. So when Indigenous Australians introduce themselves to each other, it's usually around their kin and their place of origin. So, you know, an elder that we've been working with, Mary Graham, she would say she's a woman from Helensvale, and she would introduce her mother's side and her father's side, and she would explain the place that she's from. That's not just a odd kind of cultural practice. That actually is evidence of this very deeply ingrained stewardship. And Mary calls it in her research work a sacralized ecological stewardship, which is in essence, again, alluding to the fact that this notion of sacralized is to indicate that they don't require this written law, this body of legislative work. It's an obligation. It's a cultural obligation that you are caring for country, and there is this connection that might be described as kinship or stewardship or custodianship. I mean, again, it's sometimes tricky to translate this into the right English words, but it is a very different kind of way of saying, well, you don't require a punitive framework of penalties, or, you know, threatening of fines or imprisonment when you do the wrong thing. The doing the wrong thing still gets policed through a system of governance, but the governance is much more based on this cultural obligation to care, to be caring for country. And so that's I think this very profound radical shift at the core of ontological beliefs, that we are now kind of going back into the design world and saying, well, if we were to take this as first principle, everything changes, right? Like our approach to participation changes, our approach to design briefs changes, like the whole double diamond changes, like, you know, anything that you touch that the design world often takes for granted needs to be then rethought in this light of a relational ethos. And this relational ethos is this kind of, you know, profound source of realizing how we have for such a long time be so complicit in this planetary ecocide. Really? And it causes for a lot of our students, but even for colleagues, a lot of anxiety, eco-anxiety in essence, and grief. But we are also trying to use that anxiety and the grief to then channel that towards something more productive and constructive, where we are saying, okay, we got to now start this work of coming to terms with how we, you know, become, acknowledge our complicity, but also become more the, you know, the force for good, for making change. And so a lot of that work in my personal view is about activism, to actually fight the establishment and try to work from within. As a professor, it opens a lot of doors. I can go into advisory bodies. I've just been nominated to be on an advisory body for our federal minister for transport and infrastructure. She probably has no clue what she invited herself into her inner circle, but I'm going to have some fun there.
Thank you.
That's great.
That's fantastic. But just before we jump into discussion, just a quick question from Hira.
Yeah.
You know, you were dealing with politics of more than human forms. And then Marcus also pointed out the legislation part. So when there was this worldview that all humans are equal, but some humans are more equal than the others. So, and likewise, while you're dealing with this whole dilemma of more than human forms, and we're dealing with political structures in legislative spaces, how do you develop that hierarchy of what's important and what's not? Yes, Hira.
I think a lot of this work is about diluting those hierarchies that exist in the first place. And I think, like Marcus sort of talked about this indigenous, there's a concept by Vanessa Watt, place thought, that it sort of equalizes humans and non-humans on the same plane, where it says that both sort of originate from place, and that is where they derive their agency from. And I think in a lot of aspects, like the select humans might be like racial discriminations or women people from global south that might be adversely being affected by things like climate change, while they might not be contributing as much of a contributing factor as the Western world. I think it's sort of about diluting those hierarchies of who is important and considering every being as equal within that system.
Yeah, thank you, Hira. Over to Usman to proceed with the presentation. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I would love to continue this conversation with both of you in detail because it spins up so many other avenues of inquiry. And I hope we can kind of keep the conversation going. Oh, I just saw, I was about to move over. I saw Afreen has a question.
Hira, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about when you say that both humans and non-humans have agency. And I think that you mentioned that if humans don't interfere with non-humans, they would have agency in their habitat. And I'm not quite following how, because I don't know of a time when human beings have not interfered with non-humans. And I feel like human beings have had a devastating impact on all non-human flora, fauna, animals, and plants. And I just, it's hard for me to fathom, even if we're not, even in the most green and most equitable habitat, I feel like our actions, suppose we're doing something in Karachi or something's being done in the US and the Amazons are getting, you know, still they're going to impact, climate change is still going to impact them. The glaciers, it's not like we're going and dumping our garbage in the glaciers, but the glaciers are still melting. And I couldn't really, I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit when you talk about agency of non-humans, because we're working exactly on that relationship and it's very difficult for me to fathom how human beings can ever not have an impact and how non-humans can ever have agency. I think it would be very enlightening for us, even as we put our performance together. We will talk about that later, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
I don't think I ever meant to say that non-humans have agency only when humans don't disrupt. I think non-humans always have agency. And I think melting of glaciers or floods are in essence also a form of non-human agency. And it sort of is a reaction to human agency being used in a wrong way. For example, like it's built on a floodplain, so it frequently floods every like 10 years or something. There's a very major flood. And I think the previous indigenous people who lived more harmoniously with nature, like you said, that there was always some disruption humans were causing, but there were also communities that were living harmoniously with nature. And for up to 40,000 years, those indigenous communities sort of realized that the river has its own rhythm and it flows. And that's what the floodplain is for. So they didn't construct on the floodplain. But now, like, humans have come in and they have, mostly they were like British settlers. And they constructed the city on the floodplain. And then they started sort of labeling nature or the river as the evil entity that needs to be tamed through engineering solutions. So it does not flood. But I think whether or not non-human agency shows up in a different way, but even if you take humans out of the planet, like this planet would still survive.
I think it would flourish.
Yeah, it would flourish. That's the thing. And I think all humans have to do, and humans are not something that we need to see as external to nature either. We are part of that nature and we are part of that system. But for some reason, we have decided to disrupt that ecological balance way more than any other species. And I think we just need to learn how to live harmoniously. Some examples of communities who were doing that, and I think it's largely a change in mindset, like Marcus was saying, that we are so economically driven today that we cannot fathom what a different world would look like where humans could possibly live harmoniously with nature. But that's quite possible. It's just that the way we see the world now in our worldview, that seems impossible.
It's really fascinating what you guys were talking about. I'm actually in a conference in Sweden now about talking about some of the things about design justice. And so some of the things that you guys were talking about really chime with what's happening. But I think what was interesting was there was a talk earlier on about AI and journalism and this idea of projecting a lot of things that we are doing with machines and technology is that we are projecting our human thoughts onto what the machines are trying to say, even though like humans, machines are like more than humans as well, where they are not given a voice to speak, but we will understand the intelligence. So coming back to this whole resonance, which is about creating novel interface for humans and non-human interaction, in terms of design itself, what, in a sense, I guess I'm curious to hear from you guys, what are the things that we maybe should not be doing for design as a design, as in what are the things that is actually a no-no in your experience?
Hero, what comes to mind? What's a big no-no?
I think more than design, I would still say that design is a product of your thought, and we need to mainly change our approach to how we view the world and what we are trying to do. And I think design would automatically change, because right now a lot of the design are sort of very tech oriented, driven by tech firms, and they are largely for profit. And even I think the way you're talking about like design of machines, and I think now there's a lot of criticism in smart cities about like surveillance and breach of privacy and a lot of other stuff, and I suppose technology in itself is again being programmed by what we want, or there are always invested interests of people who are funding these kind of technologies. So until that mindset changes of what we want, I think my answer would be that design practices would automatically change, but there's no point of changing a output or a symptom without really reflecting what's happening behind that. Yeah.
Can I make it into a specific example? Just to probe this question further, because I think it's a really key one. One of our participants, who unfortunately is not here, but he will watch the recording, so I'm going to ask the question on his behalf. He is working on an outdoor projection game. And what he's looking to do is for the controllers to control the video game to be plants. And they're going to be, he's going to wire them up with sensors so that you touch and stroke and interact with the game through the plants. Now, his thinking is that he wants people to take care of the plants, but still play the game and kind of feel that tension, if you like, between, you know, the desire in a game to compete, but you've actually got to be careful with the plant. But he sees a dilemma, and this might go to the sort of question that Ling is asking about, like, is this too far? Which is that the plants have no say in the matter, and there's very good chance they are going to be damaged or even destroyed through this interaction simply because humans are so clumsy. Should he not do that? Or is that potentially the point of the project?
Here's something we prepared earlier. That's funny that question's come up and that your colleague is working on this. Because we here and I have another colleague, Susan. And Susan is part of our research group, as you can see from this title. This is a paper that she's just had accepted a couple of days ago in the International Journal of Human-Computer Studies, because her PhD focuses on plants and human-plant interaction, and she's done her own experiments, in essence, looking into how we can change care regimes in office buildings for what, in essence, is usually just seen as garnish, as decoration, as like a, you know, part of the inventory of the furniture. And so her experiments were about challenging some of these assumptions and trying to elevate plants to living co-inhabitants. This particular piece that was accepted was her review of quite a long list of different studies that utilize plants, and so she's categorized them and she's come up with a taxonomy. But you're completely right. There is actually this, in essence, this conundrum that, you know, the plant is then becoming a utilitarian object. It becomes material. It becomes material input for an interaction design prototype experiment. What do we do? And even in our own experiment, we had plants that died. You know, is this ethical? So there are some papers, for instance, cited in here, recent ones published at Designing Interactive Systems, for instance, and in Tokai, that looked into the ethical implications. Should we extend the ethical clearance process from not just looking at humans? I mean, there's animal ethics as well if you do animal studies, but plants are not covered, and insects are not covered either. I got colleagues that work on bees and fruit flies, and you know, insects are not covered under animal ethics either. So if you rip out their wings, you know, a scientist can do anything to insects. And I think a couple of other animal species as well. I'm not sure where fish stand there, but I'll send you the link to this. This just actually was published. It's open access as well, so anyone should be able to click on it and get a copy of it. I think there is quite a good selection of papers cited, so you get a good overview of this topic if you want to pass this on to that colleague.
Yes, Sunila.
Okay. I'm actually working on an island off the coast of Karachi with the fisherman community, which is surrounded by mangroves. And mangroves are being cut both by the fishermen to be used as fuel wood, and also by bigger industry for selling the wood. So my kind of premise is about working with the school kids over there. Because it's a low-income community and they're mostly fishermen, so the culture of poverty is very much prevalent there, and they also use the wood for economic reasons. So I'm starting out doing a narrative building and a public engagement exercise where a week, and I'm going to start out with asking, going into the school and asking the kids 10, 11 years old, and telling them some stories about mangroves, and I'm in the process of writing that story. And questions like, what if the mangroves start reclaiming their space? And the idea of we instead of just I, and talking about how we will live together, how we should live together. The mangrove forest, the sea, the beach, all being part of the narrative and the larger community. And trying to work with them on decoding the we and making them, making the natural elements very much characters and part of the overall story. Creating a sense of symbiotic relationship of togetherness and, you know, the relationship between human and non-humans, where the non-humans have equal agency in the way decisions are taken about them.
Yes, Hira and Marcus. Yes. Over to you, Hira. Thoughts and questions.
I think, yes, I really like the idea of connecting young children. And I think that sort of also reminds me of over here in Australia, their indigenous communities have this idea of totems, where every kid that is born already has a totem that represents an animal or plant. With that totem, and they sort of take it as their responsibility to take care of that animal or plant within the environment, so that association is built within kids of non-human beings around them since they're born. So they take that along with them. And I think the idea of maybe bringing out stories from the past as well, of how communities have lived with mangroves in that areas, and what was the evolution, and maybe sort of seeing what could be what were the healthier times, or what were the times that mangroves were healthier, and how humans were interacting with mangroves at that time. And maybe also involving kids, I think it's a good idea, because then you sort of create that empathy within them from a younger age, which largely the youth is very disconnected from the outside world.
Thank you.
Look, I'd add a couple of comments. It's a fantastic project. What I think is really impressive is turning the table around and learning from local communities. I think often the modus operandi for consultants, designers, and so forth is that we try to go in, and in essence, the stereotype is that we are like parachutes. We are parachuting down, and we dispense our knowledge and our methods and our creativity. But in this particular case, you seem to be very, very sensitized to the local knowledge, the tacit kind of practices there, and trying to put that to the foreground, which is, I think, really, really good. I think so much can be learned from the way local communities are currently already operating in harmony with nature, and that needs to be amplified and learned from, rather than looking at these, big capital S sustainability approaches that are in essence often just used in order to continue business as usual for capitalist systems. So here I mentioned in the beginning of her presentation, David Abrams' book, where this term "more than human" actually in essence comes from and was coined. The book itself, I think, if you are not familiar, would be really useful for your project, because he goes on this whole worldwide tour of providing examples across the world of different First Nations communities that are living in harmony with natural ecosystems. And the book is called The Spell of the Centuries. And it actually is the overarching story of trying to read nature. So he kind of makes a connection between us learning how to spell, as in read and write, and spell as in the magic, the magic kind of trick. And so there's this connection of the magic of nature that we've actually unlearned. We've in essence forgotten how to read seasonality, how to read trees, birds, wildlife movements, fauna and flora, and so forth. And so whilst we learn how to read letters, we've unlearned the oral way of navigating in the natural world. And so I think there is a lot of parallels with the example you got there with the mangroves. The other two pieces that you might want to look at, I put this in the chat here, is the Feral Atlas, which is a project at Stanford University that is just using anthropological approaches to study nature in more than human worlds. And also this recent book, In the Shadow of the Palms, which looks at West Papua and the kinds of two sides of nature seen as as a friend, as something useful. I think one of the examples that she had there was a beetle versus the bug. Like, a beetle can be, an element of nature, but then Western or agricultural views might be that it's a pest, that we need to use toxics and pesticides to kill it, because it's in the way of us yielding our, profits from the agricultural pursuits. And so she's really going quite deep into these two sides of the same coin, in essence, which might be similar with the mangroves and the wood, because I saw that picture of them harvesting the timber. So you also have, in essence, the appreciation of them as a natural ecosystem, but they're also benefiting in their own local economy from the produce, in essence, that has been harvested there from the mangroves.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. It also kind of works. What you're talking about is You know, how the fishermen are also kind of losing the natural ways of telling, you know, navigating the sea and all of that because, again, because of this disconnect with nature and what the forefathers once had, they've actually lost that knowledge also. So that is something also which can be, you know, brought back as a story, as a narrative.
Yeah. Another quick thing, our state library here in the state of Queensland, they've set up a network that's called Indigenous Knowledge Centres, and it's precisely to, in essence, counteract what you just described, which is this loss of native practices, indigenous practices, local wisdom, the kind of wisdom that gets communicated through oral histories from. So these Indigenous knowledge centers are there to, in essence, provide support for that not to be lost, and perhaps that's a model that could be that you could borrow from.
Thank you very much.
On these notes, but just to add what Sunila was referring to, especially with regards to Indigenous communities, but there are a lot of communities like you mentioned in Australia. They did not even have a separate word for nature because they did not consider nature as something out there. They were part of it. But what Sunila is also trying to address and juggle with is the kind of participatory model, because rather than having that parachute research or parachute intervention of consultancy that, okay, we know and this is how we're going to do this.
Yeah.
You, you know, sort of come across interesting models of navigating through that kind of relationship. Between, okay, as co-creators, co-participants in the process, rather than, you know, the other way around, where you you go and do the thing.
The closest one that I'm currently engaged in is actually, in essence, critiquing some of the participatory approaches, especially in design and design thinking, because in a nutshell, the main critique is that they are assuming that we're all one happy family, right? We all bring everyone together. Close the door, throw around butcher's papers, post-it notes and crayons, and we do some design activities and we're all a happy family. And there's the minister sitting next to the director general, sitting next to the CEO, sitting next to the student. And all the hierarchies are gone. The design facilitator is bending all the rules of you know, the real world from 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock. And then we go home and then reality kicks back in. And so that, you know, I'm exaggerating, but the critique of design thinking and participatory approaches is often that it assumes a world that then has too stark of a clash at the end of the day when design creativity needs to be translated into the realities of institutional frameworks, meeting minutes, approval processes, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so the alternative that we've explored or started to explore is that of intermediation. So intermediation is a little bit different to just participation. It actually recognizes that it's useful to keep people apart until the time is right. So it's much more based on studying and researching the social context and background of individuals, of power relationships, of institutions, understanding what their interests are. And this is particularly, I think it comes very natural in Indigenous communities because of the relational ethos. So they in essence, they ask those questions straight away, as in where are you from? Who is your kin? What's your history and background and so forth? So they would kind of know, okay, you had, you know, maybe a problem with this and this family clan, with this tribe, with these kinds of kind of situations. So they are much more natural in this inter-community diplomacy. And I think we often come into the house with, you know, the door crashing in, and that can be very off-putting at best. And it can be offensive at worst. And so intermediation is, in essence, a supplement to a lot of the design thinking because it introduces this level of social cultural diplomacy, which looks for mutual beneficial outcomes, but at the same time, it also recognizes human nature in terms of these these type the complexity of these relationships.
Thank you. Hira, any point you want to make on this?
I think it's not exactly a model, but working with a participatory framework, like at least the experience that I had is, of course, letting the participants have that agency in narrating their stories and keeping it as unfiltered as possible and sort of making them feel empowered in that process, where as sometimes as curators, we sort of making sure that their stories shine through. And also I think processes like giving them sort of co-authorship or co-title with work where they can sort of share that as proudly as, oh, I contributed to this artwork, or this is how I engaged in a storytelling practices. So for kids, that sort of becomes a maybe something that they want to take forward, use these skills elsewhere.
So thank you, Hira and Marcus and everybody else.